disagreement, although not a bit of disagreement, with Secretary Benson over the repeal of the excess profit tax. You want to pick up at that point, and I understand that had nothing to do with your determination to return to Kentucky, that you'd been thinking about that for some time.
Oh, and he and I had agreed on it for some time.
But you'd merely been there to help get him acclimated as Secretary of the Treasury.
Yeah. Now, perhaps since we're leaving Washington, at least in a metaphorical sense, I think I would like to summarize just a little bit, if it's not excessive verbosity, what I would regard as the highlights of the work that I was engaged in Washington, emphasizing that in many cases I was only on the outer fringes, am not portraying myself as a sort of a major figure at the center of everything. I was closer to the center of some things than of others, but I was just thinking the other day about what those things were, because I was having a visit from my friend Joe Rao, who remembers all those things so well. And of course, I've talked about my experience with Justice Frankfurter, and I've dealt with that at some length. I think the highlights were my work in the Department of Justice with respect to reforming the practice of the immigration system, getting the refugee artists and intellectuals out of Germany, then my work at the Office of Emergency Management, which was sometimes known as the Lend-Lease Administration, in which we worked on speeding up supplies for England and Russia before we got in the war, where I worked with Phil Graham and Joe Rao, Oscar Cox, and quite a few others, and where we got involved also in the so-called Victory Program, which was a program to enlarge the defense effort in the way of munitions and planes and supplies to a level which would permit a victory in the war, and not merely to keep Britain alive or keep Russia alive. And in that connection, we worked very closely with a great Frenchman who was one of the most brilliant and effective men I've ever known in the world. He was at that time working for the British supply mission, being in exile from France, and his name was Jean Monnet, M-O-N-N-E-T, who later was the architect of the common market and of the European Economic Community, which was certainly one of the great economic and political achievements of the post-war period. And we worked very closely with him. And the principal effort of all that was to raise our sights enough, because the War and Navy departments, particularly in the beginning, were very slow to assess the magnitude of the task that faced us in producing enough supplies, not merely to keep the Germans from overrunning the British and the Russians, but to turn this around and win the war. And all that effort was based on the underlying and unstated assumption that we were eventually going to be in the war. We didn't know how we'd get in it or when we'd get in it, but we never had any doubt that we would be in it. That was the second major task on which I worked, just as one of several. And the third, and the one where I probably played the biggest part, although not the most, not the biggest, but the biggest as far as I was concerned, was the economic stabilization effort from 1942 till the end of the war, in restraining wages and prices, keeping the civilian economy functioning, and at the same time providing enough material to fight the war. And I really believe that the accomplishments of that effort to manage the economy during World War II were almost miraculously successful. We spent 50% of the gross national product on the war. We restrained inflation. We had less inflation during that World War II than we had during the late 70s and the early part of this decade, much less inflation, and at the same time actually increased the civilian standard of living. The civilian living standard of this country was better at the end of World War II than it was before we went in World War II, despite all the resources of manpower and all the resources of materiel that we put into the war. And that was I have always thought was a very significant accomplishment. And it wasn't without flaws, but it was significant, and I was always very proud to have had a small part in it. Of course, men like Justice Burns and Judge Vinson, Leon Henderson and Paul Porter, and William H. Davis, chairman of the War Labor Board, all played major parts in it, much more so than I did. But it was a very, very significant achievement. So I felt when I left Washington that I was very happy and proud to have had a part in some very significant activities, even though my part in them was perhaps insignificant.
Now, before we leave Washington, let me just toss out some names and individuals or groups that may or may not have been prominent, you may or may have had some opinions on, but they were certainly active during that time. A fellow named Francis Townsend.
Oh, old Dr. Townsend? I never knew him. He was a fellow out in California.
Well, how do you assess his impact on the times?
Oh, I think he had a big impact. I think his proposal was crazy, but I think his impact on the times was great. He had a lot to do with the improvements in Social Security, with the whole, you know, in that sense, he was a kind of an illiterate prophet of what you might call the age of the Gray Panthers. He first mobilized. He fell onto the secret of mobilizing the old people, the elderly people, as a political force, and the needs of the elderly as a high priority item on the public agenda. He himself was kind of half nuts, and he was going to give every old person $200 a month, which at that time was a phenomenal amount of money, and finance it by a so-called transactions tax, which would have been very inflationary. But you might say that things like Social Security and Medicare, Meals on Wheels, and many of the things that have come to benefit the oldest people of this country got a great impetus from Dr. Townsend, although I thought he was a nut.
Do you think that was a general perception of Dr. Townsend at
yeah.
the time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know anybody, you know, any thoughtful person in public life that took him seriously as a person. But they took the forces that he unleashed as very serious, namely the older people that wanted better treatment.
About Father Charles Edward Coghlan.
A sort of a demagogue, eloquent demagogue, who at first latched on to the discontent of the 30s and the failures of the economy, and appealed very much to those people, the small merchants, the small farmers, the small business people who were feeling themselves dispossessed first by the Depression and second by the advent of large corporations, large business enterprises, and he built and played on their resentment. He was a monetary crank, wanted to monetize silver as a solution for all the problems, and he had a lot of banking legislation he proposed, most of which was kind of irrational, but he had a great impact on stirring what I'd say, what the French would call and the Marxists would call the petty bourgeoisie, the small middle class people, into resentment. But of course he turned that resentment, like some of the dangerous European demagogues or sought to turn it, into racism, bigotry, anti-Semitism, and he really became a kind of apologist for the Nazis before he was silenced by his bishop. And I thought he was a very dangerous man. But I think Roosevelt, through the New Deal, and particularly the Second New Deal, and some of the things like reforms in taxation designed to redistribute wealth more equitably, some of his other programs, I think he defused Townsend and Huey Long to a great extent.
What about Huey Long?
Huey Long was one of the most brilliant people that was ever in public life. He was almost a genius. He was eloquent, bright, effective, completely cynical, ruthless. But he like Coghlan, appealed to somewhat the same constituency, except his was more Southern and Coghlan's more Midwestern and Western. But they appealed to the little people. And Long had his program, Every Man a King and Share the Wealth, all of which was very vague, all of which dealt in generalities. And at the same time he was proposing those seemingly radical measures, he himself was trading and dealing with the oil companies and the other special interests in Louisiana. But he had a tremendous impact on the feelings of humble people. And they in a way, you know, threatened Mr. Roosevelt on his left flank, but he defused them very effectively. And then of course the assassination of Long and the coolness of the church authorities toward Father Coghlan really ended there. You know, Long never left a movement that had any vitality. Once Long was shot, it was all gone. It was really a highly personalized effort. His eloquence and his brilliance was the whole thing. And there never was anybody associated with him in his organization that was capable of carrying anything long on, and there was no permanence to it. Coghlan was the same way.
Is there a comparison to be made between Father Coghlan and Jerry Falwell, moral majority?
Yes, except that Coghlan.
I know we're getting ahead, but I don't
know. Yeah, Coghlan touched on very real problems, and so did Long. I mean, the people that they mobilized had real suffering, real problems, real deprivation. People who had, mostly they were people who'd accumulated a little bit and had become impoverished. They weren't so much the people at the very bottom of the heap. They were the people who had maybe accumulated enough to have a little business or a little farm or a little home or a fairly decent white collar job and had been wiped out by the Depression and who felt that they had been pushed down the scale. Falwell, I think, appeals to some of those same people. But Long and Coghlan were preaching to them about their economic grievances. Jerry Falwell is preaching to them about their social and moral grievances, abortion, homosexuality, loss of family ties.
What about nuclear weapons?
Well, they're extremely. Huey Long never had much, you know, interest in foreign policy. He was sort of an isolationist, and so was Coughlin. You know, both of them were really wanting us to turn inward. Falwell really has a foreign policy, and what he's doing is preying on the emotions of those people who somehow feel that America is weakened in the world, and that we can no longer make our writ run throughout the world, and we're dealing with forces that are powerful in the world, like the Soviet Union and the Third World. And I think in that case, Falwell is cultivating a kind of xenophobia. And a feeling that we must militarize.
What about a gentleman like Henry A. Wallace?
Well, I knew, now you named the first one that I really knew.
I was just interested in your perception of what these people were like at the time, what the reaction to them, what the impact they may have had on them.
Well, I knew Mr. Wallace. I knew Secretary Wallace very well. We used to take walks together, and we were personal friends, and somewhere I've got an autographed picture that he gave me. I think Henry Wallace had a fertile mind. He had a strong conscience. He was a very decent man. He was not a very, I don't know how to explain it, he wasn't a very, didn't have a hard mind. He was a little soft. And his ideas about the century of the common man and 60 million jobs and a good many of the other things that he advocated were very sound and later turned out to seem much less unusual and unattainable than was the case when he was made fun of. But I think there was a mystical side to Wallace that made him very vulnerable. You know, he got involved with the guru letters, got to believing that you could communicate with people in the other world. And that mystical side weakened him as a public man. And then when he...
Was that a period of mysticism?
Sometimes. But not generally. No, not generally. I would say less so than now, maybe. But he was taken up by it. And then when Truman kicked him out of the cabinet when he opposed the Cold War policies, Wallace found that he was embraced by the communists and their sympathizers in this country. And a good deal of the effort that went into his 1948 campaign for the presidency came, not all of it, but a great deal of it came from people who were closely tied to the communist movement. And I think this weakened and impaired his effectiveness because he seemed very naive about the communists and about their influence. While I was never paranoid about the communists, I think I knew their modus operandi, and I always felt it, that they could kill any movement that allied itself with them, and Wallace was hurt by that. And of course, once he made that race, he was never a force again.
Was he a man of ego?
I wouldn't have said supreme ego. No, I would have said not.
But he actually thought that it wasn't that he was just motivated by his own self-image necessary.
No, I think he was very idealistic, very sincere, but a little fuzzy. I think he, and much of what he thought was very intelligent. His programs about agriculture were intelligent. I think his notions about the post-war economy were intelligent. But I think on foreign policy, his opposition to the Cold War, while it had some good points, I mean, the Cold War wasn't a policy that was undebatable. There were things about it. And ultimately, the Cold War had its excesses, and we had to retreat. And really, the beginning of the retreat from the Cold War was President Kennedy after the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was the beginning of our retreat from the Cold War. But Wallace was ineffective in his opposition to the Cold War because he was naive and didn't see that we really did face a problem with the Soviet Union. Now, whether the Cold War was the right way to deal with it's another question, although I think it would have been pretty hard to not be involved in some heavy conflict with the Soviet Union after the war, World War II. But there might have been better ways of dealing with it than the Cold War. But Wallace didn't have them. Wallace, it seemed to me, he was rather naive about it.
What about a group called Progressive Citizens of America?
Well, that was the organization he formed to be his political.
And he formed that?
Well, I thought
I'm
he
asking.
Was,
I'm asking.
I think he was the chairman of it. I think he was the chairman of it. It was the beginning of his third party in 1948. This is what happened, as I recall. In 1944, you know, Mr. Roosevelt always had not only the mainline Democratic Party, but he always had groups in his campaigns that were allied to progressive forces and nonpartisan forces outside the mainstream of the Democratic Party. I believe that in 1944, in his campaign, you had two of those forces. One was the CIO Political Action Committee, headed by Sidney Hillman, which was primarily bent on mobilizing labor in the Roosevelt campaign, and the Progressive Citizens Political Action Committee, which was formed to enlist the intellectuals and the nonpartisan progressives. And I'm not sure that Henry Wallace wasn't the chairman of that. He certainly, Rex Tugwell was in it. Henry Wallace was in it. And then when the Cold War came, they split off from the Truman administration and became the Progressive Citizens Political Action Committee, and that was the nucleus of Wallace's third party, the Progressive Party.
What about the Americans for Democratic Action?
That was formed in reaction to Henry Wallace. When Wallace carried the Progressive Citizens Political Action Committee in effect into opposition to the Truman administration and to the policies of resistance to the Soviet Union, many progressives, left of center people in the political structure, felt there was a need for a liberal or left of center organization that was not compromised by connection with communists and communist sympathizers. And it made clear the opposition of the progressive movement in this country to communism and totalitarian methods. It was what used to be called then a movement to mobilize the non-communist left, not to leave the left, or what passed for the left in our political structure, to the communists. And a group met in, I believe, 1946 or early 1947 for the purpose of organizing liberals and progressives for independent political action, friendly to the Democratic Party, but not wholly its captive, and clearly separated from those elements in the left and in the labor movement which were sympathetic to the communist cause.
Now, are you active in...
I was one of the founders of it, along with Joseph Rao, Eleanor Roosevelt, Rhino Niebuhr, Bishop Scheel of Chicago, Catholic bishop, Paul Douglas, later senator from Illinois, Ken Galbraith, Hubert Humphrey, Senator Joe Clark of Pennsylvania, many others, if I could think of them. Wilson White, who was the first national chairman of it. And I attended the organizing meeting in New York, in Washington, that set it up and was on the board for a few years.
Well, at the time it was organized, and White became the first chairperson, had he done anything to gain national prominence?
Yes. He had been, of course, he was mayor of Louisville and attracted some national attention as a big city mayor. And he had been named as federal housing administrator during the Truman administration. That attracted him some national prominence. He was seriously considered for appointment as solicitor general, which attracted national prominence. And he was well thought of by Mr. Truman. And Joe Rao had been his deputy in the housing administration. And through that, perhaps with his contacts with me and Joe Rao, he became interested in the Americans for Democratic Action when we founded, and he was the first chairman of it. His interest in it waned after a while, and he wasn't active in it in later years. And I was not either, not because I didn't sympathize with it, but I had other problems. But it continued through many years to have a real impact on our politics, though.
What about Strom and Thurmond?
Well, I had no, whatever contact. I never had any contact with him, let's put it that way. He was not in Washington when I was in Washington. I knew of him only at a distance. I never had a very good opinion of him. Always thought he was a demagogue and a racist and a reactionary, but he was not in the Senate. He is governor of South Carolina. I don't know whether he was elected that until after I came back to Kentucky.
Has he done anything over the years to make you change your opinion of him?
No, none whatever.
But he was the Dixie presidential candidate.
He was indeed, supported by Mr. Chandler and the Woodford son. The chairman of his party in Kentucky was O.W. Baylor, the editor of the Woodford son. The first name on the petition to put the Dixiecrat electors on the ballot was Mildred W. Chandler.
What, as you were getting ready to leave Washington, how would you describe, and this, I guess, is two hard questions, how would you describe your image that you envision having with your friends, your friends had of you? And on the other hand, how would you think your critics would have characterized you? And excluding President Truman, because we already talked about what some of his perhaps opinion of you. But you're bound to, you're bound to have.
I hope I made it clear that we got to be kinda good friends, Lee.
You did. You had made a comment that you knew the president. Do you wanna say something for me, Fritch?
5, 6, 7, 8.
This is side 2 of tape 9, the Edward F. Pritchard interview. This is the 13th day of April, 1983. Now, I just ask you about the images that your friends and the characterizations your critics might attribute to as you left Washington.
Well, that's hard for me to assess. It assumes perhaps a bit too much, you know, that I was a highly significant figure and that everybody lined up and took sides. I don't know that I was that important, but I would suppose that, I would suppose that what my friends thought about me would be better said by my friends. I certainly had lots of good friends who have been devoted and loyal through all the years, in and out of season, when I was in good times and in bad.
We've already seen him.
Mr. Pritchard, Dennis Benoit is calling you. Should I tell him you're calling back?
No, I'll talk to him right now. I better. Please stop a minute.
Yes. Okay, then we're back on that. Really, you know, you're bound to have had friends like Philip Graham, I'm thinking about, or Joseph Rao, or Henry Royce, who you had conversations with about your aspirations, and they would give you some idea of where they expected to go in life.
Oh, I'm sure that some of the good men of them expected me to come back to Kentucky, run for high office with a chance of success, I'm sure. But that some of that was romance. Some of that may have had some basis. They all wanted me to come back, or most of them did. But as to what they thought about all the particular traits of my character and personality, I'd rather leave them to say. I can tell you what my critics would have said, that I was ambitious and brash and bumptious and smart-alecky and inclined to be indiscreet and reckless.
Compton, well, they said you were Compton.
Well, I don't know. I would have said, I don't know. I don't remember very many people ever being caught saying that I was stupid or incompetent, but if they said it, it didn't get to me. I'm sure there were some that thought I was too smart for my own good.
Well, in your own perception, what was the difference between the Ed Pritchard leaving Washington and the one that came there as a clerk to Justice Frankfurt?
Not very much, except that I'd had more experience, met more people, had a little broader perspective on things. But I don't think there'd been any fundamental change. You know, I just had a bigger canvas to paint on and bigger scene to play in, but I don't know that I had played all that major a part. But I don't really believe I've changed much more since I've been here than I ever changed in the years I was there.
Well, at what point did you actually decide to come back to Kentucky, and at what point did you start making preparation, such as decisions about where you're going to practice law, with whom you're going to practice?
I don't know that there ever was a time when I didn't intend to come back to Kentucky. I had always had it in mind to come back here and practice law and be active in public affairs. I don't think I had any specific ambition, even though some people may find that hard to believe, that I have any specific ambition to be hold some office. I certainly never ruled that out, but I never believed that it was wise to set one's whole life to the goal of some specific ambition, because that made disappointment too galling if one didn't get it. But I certainly was was interested in public office, public life. Justice Frankfurter, from the time I knew him in law school, always encouraged me to return to Kentucky. He and his mentor, Brandeis, always felt that young people ought, in greater measure than was the fact, go back to their own communities and try to play an active part in life and affairs. So there never was any time that I didn't intend that. I don't know that I ever considered going to New York or practicing in Washington. Never a time in that period. And it was always just assumed by my friends that I was going to return when the war was over.
Well, did you ever have any offers to overtures from law firms or friends to practice in New York or Washington?
Never serious ones, because they always knew what my intentions were. And I don't recall a serious overture or offer that I had. Now, I had one suggestion when I was about to come back. Tom Clark, who was that time who was Attorney General at that time, and Robert Hannigan, who was Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, suggested that I become the head of the Antitrust Division in the Department of Justice. And I told them with thanks that I wanted to come back here and that I didn't think that would be consistent with my intention to come back here. But that was just always my intention, and I had my time set to come back when the war was over.
Well, at what point did you, had you always kind of thought to come back and practice with Phil Ardrey?
I don't know about always, but we had talked about it even when I was in law school. And we discussed it when he got out of the service. And we just decided to do it.
Well, he didn't have an ongoing practice or a set of practice at the time then you all went together?
That's right. It was right when he got back. He perhaps had opened an office in Frankfurt a couple of months earlier, but we had always had that intention. And we had, my office was in Lexington, his in Frankfurt. We were partners. We'd go back and forth.
Well, how was it starting law practice then? Was it difficult, or did you find a class ready for you to open your doors?
Well,
did you have a particular kind of law you wanted to practice, or you want to be a small country lawyer?
I don't know that I had ever thought all that much about it. We did well. We had just the kind of clients you would ordinarily get in a place like Lexington or Frankfurt. We represented rural electric co-ops for several years. I suppose originally when I opened the office, there were probably a goodly number of people that wanted to employ me or employ us, but primarily me in this aspect of our practice, on matters in Washington. Tax matters, price administration matters, things in Department of Agriculture, things of that sort. There was some of that in the early stages. But, we did well. I don't know how phenomenally well, but we did well. I had no great problems.
Now, at what point did Bob Houlihan come to practice with you?
Or was he ever a partner? Did he share offices? Or?
No, no. He was an associate. He got out of the service, and he was looking for a place to come, and he came in Lexington and was with me till he went with Stahl, Keenan, and Park. Al Funk was in with us. He had just gotten out of law school.
Now, what year would this have been, Richard?
Well, I came 26. Back. We opened up in the fall of 1945.
And how long back were you back before you began to take part in state politics, or local politics, that matter?
Well, I don't guess I was back at all. I expect, I did a little of that before I ever came back. You know, when I was in Washington, I would keep in some touch with Kentucky politics. And when I was in Washington, Earl Clements had been elected to Congress and came up, I believe he was elected in the fall of 1944. And so he got to Washington in January 1945. I had known him before. He and my father had been in the legislature together, he in the Senate and my father in the House. And my father liked him very much. And he and I formed a close friendship almost from the beginning. That friendship has continued ever since. And I suppose he was my two closest allies or friends in Kentucky politics in that period were Earl Clements and R.P. Maloney Sr. Dick was in the state Senate, was the floor leader, Democratic floor leader in the Senate, and his office was in the same building as mine here in Lexington, and we got in the habit of eating lunch pretty nearly every day out at Bud Adams. You remember that place?
Yes, indeed.
Well, we'd go out to Bud Adams and eat lunch. Bob Stills used to eat with us sometimes. Bob Houlihan. And Bob wasn't all that much tied up in politics, but Prentice Douglas, who's an insurance man here in town, has still in business. His office was in our building. We were all cronies politically.
How would you describe R.P. Maloney?
Well, he was a unique person. He was witty and bright, very astute politically, had a little something of a temper, had a razor-edged tongue, rather inclined to be sarcastic. Didn't have many of the graces of a politician in the sense he was not a great handshaker. He was inclined to be somewhat abrupt, but he had a sharp tongue that he could turn easily on himself, and he was a great wit, a good organizer. And I think through the years of his service in the legislature, became more and more addicted to really a concept of public service. When Dick started out, he was kind of a precinct politician, strictly an organization man, but his legislative experience greatly broadened it. And he probably was the most effective legislator that I have ever known in Kentucky. Became that. More skillful at organizing the legislature, more skillful at piloting legislation through or killing bad legislation. He was a man of great brilliance. And yet in many ways kind of a shy man. But I enjoyed him very much and admired him very much.
Do you recall any anecdotes about Mr. Maloney?
Oh, I can recall some of his, he was inclined to be rather abrupt and inclined to have strong likes and dislikes. I can remember some of his, some of the things he used to say. If he got mad at somebody and was fixing to operate on him, his great phrase was, "I'll make his ass pop like new leather." Meaning that he'd give him a good whipping. He was, he knew how to operate in the realm of ideas and policies and in the most practical ways also. He became a very powerful force in the Clements organization, a very powerful force in the legislature. Became the dominant force in Fayette County Democratic politics. More or less before him, the dominant forces here had been people like Ernest Thompson and Walter Rhodes Sr., some of the old timers, and he just annexed them. And really was pretty much a supreme force in there. He had come out of the old Billy Clare organization originally. And he probably had a power that was equal to or more than that that Billy Clare had, had in his heyday. He was sharp-tongued, short-tempered. But
did he always remain with the Clemens faction?
Who, me?
No, Mr. Loney.
Not really. He came close to a breach during the period when Wilson White was running for governor and Bert Combs was running too, because, of course, Earl Clements was the main force in the Combs organization. Dick Maloney was for Wilson White. He got impatient because Combs couldn't make up his mind whether he's going to run or not. So when White got in the race, why, Maloney was very much for him and was probably one of the principal forces in his campaign. Then when White and Combs came together and formed their ticket, Earl and Dick came back together, but they never were quite as close as they had been before.
Well, when you go back in the fall of 45, I guess as always, the Kentucky governor's race was getting underway for what, 47?
Right.
And that would have been Waterfield and Clemens?
Right.
And you, I believe, were on the Clemens side, and your partner
was on the Waterfield
side. Waterfield side. Was that by design?
No, it certainly was not.
Like Common Rouse and Paul Ream used to do?
No.
Just philosophical differences personal differences?
Waterfield had served in the legislature with my father. My father had been a supporter of Waterfield, in the legislature. And they were good friends. And one of the clients we represented was the Rural Electric Co-op. And in the 1946 session of the legislature, there came very prominently to the fore a piece of proposed legislation called the Moss Bill, which was introduced by Senator Ray Moss, a Republican from Bell County, but was really supported and sponsored by Kentucky Utilities. And the purpose of that bill was to modify the existing legislation relating to the acquisition of private power companies by public authorities and make it more difficult, put barriers in the way of public ownership of electric power. Well, of course, our firm, in the first place, that was our belief. In the second place, it was our client's position that we were opposed to that legislation. And we had a very dramatic series of hearings and confrontations that occurred during that session. And we beat that Moss bill. There was a dramatic hearing over there in the House one night, passed the Senate. And I made a big speech against it and was credited by some people with being instrumental in its defeat. And Harry Lee Waterfield helped us in that. And I really felt very bad about the situation that put me in personally. Phil was for Waterfield and continued to be for him. And Waterfield had, Phil ran for the United States Senate in 1946. In the primary in which John Y. Brown Sr. was nominated. And of course, John Sherman Cooper defeated him in the fall in 1946. And of course, I supported Phil, contributed heavily to his campaign, raised money for him, worked for him, but he got beat narrowly. Waterfield, at least to some degree, supported him. Earl Clements, I think, sort of stayed on the sidelines, but he didn't really do anything to help Phil. And that aroused resentment on Phil's part. As far as my own relationship with Waterfield was concerned, I liked Harry Lee all right and would have been glad to be for him. But I was already committed to Clements long before this legislation came up. And Clements had assured me that if he became governor, he would not do anything to injure the electric co-ops. And I felt confident that he would keep that promise, which he did. Indeed, they got their first, what they call G&T, Certificate of Authority, during his administration. That was a certificate from the Public Service Commission that allowed them to build their generating and transmission plants, which they were very eager to get into. And that was the origin of Big Rivers and East Kentucky. They both got into business as a result of decisions made by the Public Service Commission during the Clements administration. Nevertheless, Phil felt that he was obligated to be for Waterfield, and he felt some resentment that that Clements and the Clements people hadn't really gone to bat for him in his race against Brown. Maloney, by the way, supported Phil and worked hard for him, and we carried this county over Brown by a small majority. There wasn't much vote cast in the whole state. So that was the origin of our having been divided in that race. It certainly was not a situation in which one of us decided to be on one side and one the other, because the race caused some bad feeling between Phil and me.
And when did you realize that Phil would probably run for office when you entered practice with him? Or was that kind of a revelation after the fact?
A little bit of a revelation after the fact. I didn't get him in the race. He wanted to get in, and when he wanted to get in, I helped him all I could and contributed very substantially to his campaign.
Do you think that he felt like you had done all that you could do?
Oh, yeah. Don't think it was any.
No problem there.
You'd have to ask him, but I don't think it is. I had no indication that he felt that way. But I think he did get a resentment against Clements on that, and maybe thought that I had not done what I should do for our clients because I supported Clements. I not only supported Clements, but I went out and made speeches for him.
I was going to ask you what your role in the campaign was.
Oh, very active. I worked with him all the time, went with him on speaking tours, made speeches for him all over the state. kept writing speeches.
At that time, did you pretty well know people all over the state? I'm talking about county contact people and judges and so forth. Or was this kind of a part of your learning process, an introduction process to that phenomenal network of people you seem to have out there?
I'd known them for years, lots of them, because I had been... Remember that I had been active off and on in Kentucky politics since I was a boy, and certainly since the first Chandler campaign, when I was very active for Chandler. I had supported Mr. Wallace of Paris in the first primary, but I knew he wouldn't win, and I had made my mind up early in that campaign in 1935 to support Chandler in the runoff primary. And I had something to do with the, even as a kid, with helping pull together the Clare crowd and being for Chandler. They'd been for Wallace in the first primary. And of course, as you remember, Chandler lost the first primary. And when the second primary came along, he won. So he and I were on very good terms, and through that I got to know a lot of the local people and a lot of the others. I'd known a lot of the local politicians since I was a boy. So I never felt that I acquired, but I extended my knowledge of it during the Clemens period. No question.
Can you recall any particularly colorful political characters at that time?
Oh, Doc Beecham. I got to know Doc early. John Y. Brown Sr., whom I'd known since boyhood. Judge Irvin Turner from Breathitt County, who had served with my father in the legislature.
Was that Marie's husband?
Yeah, that's right, certainly was. That's when I got to know Marie. Virgil Chapman. Lewis Cox, Dan Talbot.
Now, I realize
Bob Humphreys.
Were all these people that were initially in the Clemens organization?
Well, some of them were initially in the Chandler organization. Some of them were initially in the Tom Ray organization. I got to know them back in those years. Some of them ended up in the Clemens organization, certainly.
Well,
Doc Beecham did.
Our tape's about to go, Greg.